Welcome into the Ether, a podcast focusing on all things Ethereum, the leading blockchain for decentralized applications. I'm Eric Connor, your host and founder of ETHub, a decentralized information hub for Ethereum. Into the Ether features deep dives on topics with prominent guests in the community, as well as ETHub weekly recaps featuring Anthony Sassano. Hello, everyone, and welcome into the Ether. Today, I have Rune Christensen, founder and CEO of Maker, on the podcast. Maker is currently the most popular DApp built on Ethereum and was clearly, in my mind, the catalyst for the recent open finance movement. Thanks a lot for joining me today, Rune.
Glad to be here, man.
Thanks. So I always like to kind of start off and ask my guests how they got involved with Ethereum to begin with. I know you've been around for a long time, but kind of what is your story and how did you get involved with Ethereum?
Yeah, I started off as a really like an early adopter of Bitcoin back in 2011. And what actually happened was that at some point I plunged my life savings into Bitcoin and, you know, went through kind of the whole cycle of a bubble, right? So I saw my net worth dramatically increase. And then as I, you know, held on all the way down to the bottom, I lost all the money again. Through the, you know, and really like felt the impact of volatility on myself. And through that, I realized that you really need stability in this space before real people are going to use it, right? Like regular people are not going to be able to deal with that kind of volatility and the extreme price swings. So I actually got into BitShares initially because that was the first solution to the stability problem as they invented the very first stablecoin. And as BitShares failed to really get traction, I then finally, focused my attention on Ethereum as that was really, you know, getting more traction around the end of 2014, and ultimately decided that Ethereum was really the perfect place to try to actually create a stablecoin, right? And a proper ecosystem of stable cryptocurrency that would then finally see blockchain technology becoming available for real use in the real world.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was going to ask you if you had the vision for Maker kind of before you even heard about Ethereum, and it sounds like you definitely did. And I mean, I think we're all going through a period of high volatility over the last few months. I mean, we of course had another huge bubble and then a burst of the bubble and, you know, down 90%. I think, you know, the launch of DAI around that time, I mean, first of all, it was amazing to see how stable it stayed through the crash, and we'll get into that as well. But I think it really kind of opened people's eyes to, hey, if we're going to go mainstream here, like a lot of us might not mind holding Ether and the volatility that's related to it and Bitcoin as well, but to really go mainstream, people are going to want that stable coin to hold on to, at least for a decent amount of their portfolio.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and especially in terms of you know, building apps that are just apps for some real world issue, right? Like let's say something like a remittance app or some sort of accounting system or anything like that. I mean, at that point, people don't even want to know that there is blockchain or cryptocurrency under the hood. They just want to see US dollars, right? And then they want to save and want to get better user experience because of the efficiency and speed of blockchain. So, I mean, so that's kind of the other side of it, right? Like you need a stablecoin to be able to really hide the complicated blockchain details down in the machinery and really just, you know, show people the simple version when they actually interact with it.
Yeah, definitely. I fully agree with that. Most people just want to see US dollars, right? That's what they're used to. And at least for the next, you know, 5-10 years or whatever, as people are still getting comfortable with crypto, it's going to be a necessity. So I think that's a good background. I'd like to transition into Maker and then obviously talk about DAI and CDPs. As I mentioned in the intro, this is definitely, I mean, it has to be the most used app on Ethereum right now. There's over 2 million Ether locked in the contracts in total, at least last I checked about a week or 2 weeks ago. And I'm sure most of the listeners have heard of Maker and DAI, but can you just give kind of a quick overview on how the system works? And then also the importance of the Maker token and kind of how DAI is created?
Like very simply, right? DAI is the stablecoin that exists for regular users to be able to use blockchain and crypto without having to really worry about volatility or advanced blockchain details. But sort of DAI is really just the tip of the iceberg, right? You can say sort of the other side of the coin is this whole mechanism that backs the stability of DAI, which is really the entirety of the maker system. And you can say the first layer, or sort of the most fundamental aspect of the system that, that backs the stability of DAI, is the collateralized lending. So the CDPs, right? The collateralized debt positions that enable people to lock up collateral, post collateral into the decentralized smart contract system and use that to actually borrow DAI. And the key rule is that to borrow DAI from the maker system, you must put in an excess of collateral, right? So you must put in, let's say, $200 worth of Ethereum, and you can then use that to borrow 100 DAI. And you can then go and spend that 100 DAI on, it can be different things, right? Some people have made like these big loans to actually purchase cars or finance their business or something like that. Others have, I mean, a more standard use case is you just buy even more Ethereum. So you use the system as a way to get leveraged exposure to Ethereum. And all of this then results in DAI on one hand being this very simple, very easy to use stablecoin, right? That anyone can use to like to use crypto without the downside of the volatility. It's actually very easy to use. You know, you can, it works just like Bitcoin, except it's stable and at $1. And you don't need to worry about all the complicated stuff. Like you don't need to worry about CDPs or Maker or any of that to use DAI. And that's really what most people who use it, like that's how they use it, right? They don't go deeper than that, just like you don't need to know how the Federal Reserve works in order to use USD cash bills, right? But that advanced component of the CDPs and the underlying stability and all of that does have to exist, right? Because there must be a very strong guarantee in the system that ultimately there is more value in collateral than there is DAI in circulation, right? Like, so for instance, today there is something like 92 million DAI in circulation, and that is backed by around, yeah, something like $250 to $300 million worth of Ethereum tokens as collateral. So ultimately that really ensures this very high level of over-collateralization, right? That guarantees that even in the event of a crash in Ethereum, or something like what we saw, you know, all of last year, right? Like a slow but very persistent crash over a long period of time. Even despite that kind of volatility in the collateral, DAI remains stable throughout this. And ultimately, the way that is ensured is through the maker governance and the MKR token. So the MKR token is the governance token of the system. And ultimately, it actually votes directly in the system to set the rules of the game, essentially. It regulates what the terms and the parameters that people who deposit collateral like ETH into the system, what kind of loans they can then get. And that has to be regulated in a way that ensures that on one hand, you know, the system is as efficient as possible and doesn't just extract rent from its users, right? But actually is meant to serve the user and give them the best possible conditions. But also at the same time, keeps the whole system stable and safe, right? In the sense that there is enough collateral requirements and there is enough over-collateralization to make sure that the system can withstand even the most significant shock and impact to the collateral. So that's how all of these different parts fit together. And ultimately, it's kind of like, depending on who you are, you can decide how deep you want to go, right? Most people, they don't really worry about anything other than just DAI and just using DAI. And ultimately, they can just look at the track record of the system, right? And see that it has remained stable for more than a year at this point. The more advanced users, they actually use the CDPs and actually borrow from the system. And ultimately, the real, like those who really want to go deep and really want to be specialists and actually be a part of governing the system itself, they get into MKR and sort of the end-to-end complexities of actually governing and managing the risk of the system.
Yeah, I think that's a great explanation and kind of covers all the aspects. And I guess the most important part there is that every DAI is backed by or it's over collateralized. So if you want to escape to stability from the volatility of Ether, you can go and lock up, you know, $100 worth of Ether and you can draw down maybe whatever you want, $50 worth of DAI. So that's backed by collateral that protects it. And that's why it can, well, there's a lot of mechanisms of how it keeps stability, but that's essentially why, you know, it's backed and it can stay stable. So it's obviously, I think CDPs have been live, like it hasn't been a year, over a year now. But to this point, you've only been able to use Ether as collateral. And I know that your team's embarking soon on multi-collateral DAI and has been talking about it for a very long time. Can you kind of walk us through how this is going to work? Like, what are the different assets that people are going to be able to use? And this is for people that, you know, want to use tokens other than Ether to create DAI.
Yeah, so the current version of the system, which we call single collateral DAI, is really just a technical beta that's there to kind of like act as a proof of concept that this kind of stuff is possible and, you know, like bootstrap the initial ecosystem around the system. But ultimately, the whole innovation of Maker and DAI and the promise of it is this ability to use multiple types of collateral in the system. Because that is how you actually get real scalable and long-term sustainable stability and ultimately are able to build something that can have an impact in the real world and offer a, you know, a very compelling alternative to traditional finance. So, I mean, like you're saying, we've been working on this for a very long time. In fact, we've been working on multi-collateral for much longer than we worked on single collateral. The project really started very late 2014. So it's more than 4 years, right, that we've been working on this. And where we are now is, I would guess, in the very, very end of the launch phase, right? So everything is pretty much done. I mean, all the code is there, except some few, a few components and like a few details of the system. Most of the security work has been done, right? Like, and what we're doing now is just like this endless testing, endless like live environments, and like, you know, making sure everything fits together and all of the components and all of the aspects that go into actually having a successful launch. That involves, you know, upgrading everyone who's currently using single collateral DAI into multi-collateral DAI, for instance. As well as just like a whole lot, you know, like upgrading all our partners, getting everything, like getting it all to run smoothly. That's kind of where we're at now, right? Like preparing for that very last step of actually doing the launch itself. And in terms of a timeline, I mean, we don't know exactly when it's going to be possible to launch because it's kind of hard to predict something like, outcomes of security audits, right? And just like the timeline for like last mile polishing. But it's definitely coming very soon, right? And I'm confident it'll be this year, and hopefully sooner rather than later. And yeah, so and like I was saying, right, the transition will really be just an upgrade, right? So people who hold MKR, they will not have to do anything. They'll just be transitioned over automatically. They will have to vote for the upgrade itself, though. People who hold DAI will be presented with basically a button they have to click to upgrade their DAI from single collateral DAI to multi-collateral DAI. And the same goes for CDP users. So you have to kind of like upgrade your CDP. And then the result will be that like things should, you know, the system should just really significantly improve, right? Like liquidity will get better because there's more collateral types. The stability will get better as well. There'll be new use cases in terms of now you can add new collateral into the system. And also for sort of the governance of the system, there'll be this whole new universe of complex governance decisions that has to be made around what kind of collateral will be added to the system, which is something that we've only recently started to really get traction on and really get momentum on in terms of having this fully decentralized governance process of MKR holders from around the world actually directly, you know, participating and ultimately controlling the governance of the system.
Nice. Yeah. So are there going to be any default collateral types out of the box, or is everyone going to have to be voted on? And then kind of on that same point, do you worry at all about maybe more illiquid collateral types being added and adding risk to the system, or what are your thoughts around that?
Yeah. So there's no, I mean, ultimately MKR holders have to vote in collateral, right? So there's no such thing as default collateral, I guess, other than ETH. It's just obviously going to be added, right? Because it's currently supported. On the other hand, you could say everything is default collateral, because really the approach is not really whether something will be collateral or not. It's what are the risk parameters going to be, right? It's going to be like what kind of interest rate and what kind of over collateralization will you need for whatever coin you want to use in the system. Only like what I would call complete scams and just like completely obviously worthless stuff will not be added at all. But pretty much everything else, like if there's actually some legitimate value there, there's really no limit to what kind of assets will be added. As long as the governance process, you know, has the bandwidth to actually include it, right? So obviously there's going to be a lot of prioritization in terms of what will be added first. And there's also just like technical barriers in terms of, again, like what will we be able from a technical perspective to be able to include. But yeah, ultimately, it's going to be up to MKR holders, and the initial scope will be top ERC-20 tokens, right? Because those are the ones that are the simplest to add from the technical perspective. And as a result, that's what's going to be available to choose from at launch of MCD, right? Because the more complicated stuff, like for instance centralized stablecoins or security tokens, there's another layer of technical complexity that has to be built first before those can be added. But sort of straight up, what I would call pure ERC-20 tokens, like something like Augur, RIP, or you know Omisigo, which we did actually announce in the past that we were going to consider as collateral, those are a lot simpler to add because they're just a basic ERC-20 token. They're really no different than adding Ethereum from the technical perspective.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you definitely want to make sure, or I guess maker holders need to make sure, right, that the collateral they're adding has enough demand if something's liquidated. I guess for those maybe not aware, if your collateralization ratio slips below 150%, so say you, that example earlier, you wanted to pull out 50 DAI and you collateralized $100 worth of ETH. If Ether price slips below the collateralization ratio, your position essentially is going to be margin called. And then people are going to have to buy your Ether on the market to kind of cover your debt position. So, you know, that obviously has to be somewhat of a concern, right? For maybe some of these. I mean, once you get past maybe the top five or so top ERCs, it probably shouldn't be a worry. But what are your thoughts there? Like, how do you offset that? Is it that you think it's going to be voted that the collateralization ratio is just maybe higher than 150%?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, how to actually approach that is it already gets quite advanced in terms of how you deal with this kind of dilemma from a risk management perspective. But I guess the very short answer is that you just make sure that the less liquidity there is in an asset, the less of that asset you want to have in the portfolio, right? And then there's various ways you can control that. One very obvious way is using what's called the debt ceiling, which really just puts a cap to how much of a particular asset there can be debt in a system backed by that, right? So you could say, we will not allow more than 20 million DAI to be generated that's backed by Omisigo, right? Something like that, right? Because that's the absolute maximum we think the market can absorb. Or something, you know, like that's kind of how you would reason about this, right? Of course, in reality, it's, you know, you kind of want to have something that's a little bit more sophisticated than just some maximum cap, right? Yeah, but you know, that's something that like initially we'll start off with a relatively simple model, but ultimately we do have like highly, highly sophisticated models for the stuff that are, you know, that are basically based off traditional risk management. So how you do this in the real world when banks, for instance, you know, give portfolio margin and just relying on all the, you know, the historical and sort of the scientific basis there is behind, you know, just this advanced field of risk management. And yeah, so that ultimately gets us back to what I was saying earlier, right? That in the end, you can pretty much include anything. You just have to make sure you include it on the right terms, right? And you manage it correctly.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And the cap's a good point. I mean, you guys, when you launched, you had a smaller cap on DAI that can be created from Ether than that we're at now. And we're actually almost up on the ceiling again. I think we're, is it like 8 million DAI away or something like that? And, you know, on that point, there's been a lot of discussion recently about DAI and kind of slipping below its peg a little bit. Mainly, I think I was observing this on Coinbase where the price first USDC fell, I think, to around like 97 cents or so. And the reaction to that is a mechanism in the governance process that's called the maintenance fee for CDPs. So basically, it was raised to 3.5%. So if you think of it in a typical loan term, you're kind of, if you're taking out a CDP, you're having to pay interest on that. It's kind of moved around a little bit. It was at 0.5 at a point, and now it's been moved up to 3.5. And this was a measure to kind of get that peg back into place. Is that right? And can you kind of explain to people why, how this mechanism works to float the peg back to one?
Yeah, so the stability of DAI is fundamentally, like, I mean, the long-term stability of DAI is backed by the collateral in the system, right? That's why, that's how you know DAI isn't worthless, because you know that all that collateral is sitting there. So you're, you know, there's enough collateral in the system to back the value of your DAI. But the way to you know, the way to target the market price of DAI, right? So actually ensure that DAI really does trade around $1 in the marketplace, you know, has to, you know, that is actually a more, like, that's sort of a whole problem in of itself, right? And the way we approach that is through interest rate adjustments. So really, it's about using some of the most basic microeconomic theory to change the incentives for either adding demand to the system or adding supply to the system, right? And so the basic, so right now, what we do is we adjust the stability fees in the system. And the stability fees are actually only applied to CDPs. So they're only applied to the supply function in the system. And later we'll actually upgrade that. In multi-collateral DAI, we upgrade it to the DAI savings rate, which actually affects both demand and supply, because it also affects those who hold DAI and gives them an interest rate. But right now we're only... the system only supports changing the incentives for the CDP holders and thus changing the supply in the system. So essentially what the goal is to do is to make sure that the aggregate supply in the system more or less is balanced out by the aggregate demand, right? So basically that for every person who wants to buy DAI at $1, there's a person who also wants to sell DAI at $1, right? And what happens if there's too much on either side, right? So let's say there's too many people who want to sell DAI. What ends up happening is, you know, like, you know, kind of like supply and demand and, you know, just like the, you know, like fundamental incentives kind of step in and mean that people would now start to sell DAI below $1 potentially, right? If there's just too much supply and not enough demand. And then what you have to do is you have to modify the incentives so that you will actually be able to decrease supply and as a result, get it more in line with demand. And this is where the stability fee comes in, right? The rate for borrowing from the system, because the higher you set that rate, the less attractive it'll be to borrow out of the system. And then, yeah, like you said, right, we recently suffered more volatility than we've seen pretty much at any point in time, which was cost by a combination of very low interest rate in the system, right? A very low stability fee, plus the fact that there's this new, like, renewed, at least sideways sentiment in the market rather than a consistent bearish trend over time. And those two factors combined meant that suddenly the DAI supply just exploded. And then the governance has been playing catch up and has been really been steadily increasing the stability fee to try to balance out the supply, right, and get the supply more in line with demand. I think what we've seen now is that there's been some effect finally from this recent increase we did, where we actually jacked it up by 2% in one adjustment. But I also think that overall, this is still just, like, you know, there's still more room to go to a large extent, right? Because there's actually a lot of, like, there's a lot of factors that play into this, and not just the price in the market, but also like the overall conditions of liquidity. I mean, more than anything else, this has been a really incredible kind of like live, you know, lesson of how the system is supposed to work and the governance around the system. And especially been a lesson in what happens if the governance doesn't react fast enough, right? And also, ultimately, kind of a reinforcement of the very basic assumption that the system, such as microeconomics, actually does work, right? You can, in fact, manipulate market price by manipulating the incentives around supply and demand. Like all in all, the governance process is very likely to be able to handle this kind of issue much better in the future, right? Because it's really only been bootstrapped very recently and gotten started very recently. So overall, I think it's really exciting. I mean, there's really, in general, so much excitement around the governance process and like all sorts of, like, you know, we have reporters from CoinDesk, for instance, sitting in on the meetings now and reporting on them in real time, which I just think is really cool, right? And it's sort of a new dimension to just like how transparent and how decentralized this system is meant to be.
Do you think that over time, the process will become more efficient and faster, not necessarily automated, but, you know, almost to a point where it can react faster? And do you think multi-collateral DAI will add, like, how do you envision the governance system working efficiently when you're having to manage, say, 5 or 10 different stability fees?
Yes, I mean, I definitely think that it's going to, like, I think in the long run, it'll be essentially a highly overseen and highly, highly managed, but ultimately automatic process, right? Where you have people at all times kind of like overseeing and watching this automatic system that gets as much data as possible, that has already been agreed on by the governance, process that data with the cutting edge algorithms that we have for it, and then ultimately reacts in direct, like as close to real time as possible to the dynamics in the market, right? But that's very far out in the future, right? In the short run, I think we will achieve incredible efficiency and liquidity and stability just by getting good enough at controlling the process that we're preparing to have at launch of multilateral DAI, which is like just one adjustment every week, right? So every week we'll just like process the changes in the market dynamics and then almost always do some sort of adjustment. And then, of course, in a few cases when really the market conditions is exactly the same as they were the week before, make no change. But just in general, always try to make a bit of an adjustment based on the data we're seeing, right? I think through that, we'll already like be able to really achieve some quite incredible efficiency of monetary policy if it's also combined with a lot of different collateral.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's interesting about adjusting it weekly. Do all of those require governance votes, or is that something that's built in automatically to the system?
Yeah, so in multilateral DAI, first of all, we'll have the DAI savings rate, right? So we'll have a mechanism that actually both manipulates the incentives to generate supply in the system, but also to demand holding DAI, right? Because you'll actually be able to take your DAI and deposit it into the DAI savings contract, which will then give you a very modest, very low risk, low return, savings rate on your DAI over time, right? And this then means that when we want to change, like let's say the price is too low of DAI, right? This means that when we change the DAI savings rate, we're both going to get more demand. We're both going to get more people in who want to hold DAI because the DAI savings rate is higher. So suddenly it looks more attractive compared to alternatives such as bonds or something like that. But at the same time, increasing the DAI savings rate is also going to increase, the fundamental interest rate of all the different CDPs in the system. So it'll also affect supply, right? So we'll have this double effect of both reducing supply and increasing demand when the price is too low, bringing it more closer to the peg, right? And the same effect, but in reverse, if the price is too high, where we can actually decrease demand and increase supply simultaneously. And this will then have it, like, this will mean that we will need much smaller adjustments to have a much stronger effect. And then, yeah, like you were saying, that this will be done through, like, I would call it like a kind of like a shortcut mechanism, right? So we don't have to go through the very elaborate governance process, but rather what we do is we have the governance process essentially approve a mechanism that creates this shortcut that then allows the governors who want to participate in the stabilization to then operate within a more restricted framework where you don't need to have as much people participating. But then also there's no risk that they can just go in and like change, like, you know, make huge adjustments to the savings rate or something, right? There'll be this like very, very strict, predetermined, window within where changes can be made within, right? It'll be very easy to undo any sort of attacks or any sort of bad behavior used against this mechanism.
Gotcha. I'm personally really excited for the DAI savings rate. I mean, to be able to earn interest on DAI that you hold, first of all, it's going to add a very essential component to the system. But just from a user perspective, will be nice to kind of, you know, have a savings account type thing out there. What's your hunch on, I know it's very probably an unfair question, but where's your hunch on kind of where that DAI savings rate will be? I guess if you took like maybe today's market condition, what do you think that'll look like interest rate wise?
That is really hard to predict, right? But I think a hunch that I have is that you would end up with a DAI savings rate that was about half of the current stability fee, right? Because you have this double effect. So instead of needing to have a stability fee of, let's say, 4%, if you have the savings rate where you actually are both affecting supply and demand, it would maybe only need to be 2% because you also have a 2% effect on the demand side. It's literally impossible to predict. Like, I mean, this is such like advanced and sort of a new frontier of macroeconomics, right? That like we have no way of knowing other than just seeing how it plays out in real life. And I would also say that in general, it's going to be very volatile in the early days, right? As the system is just getting started and new collateral is getting added and it's just like growing at a steady pace, but still it's very small in the grand scheme of things. There's going to be significant volatility in the savings rate and the general rates in the system as governance just like learns the ropes, right, and gets better at controlling the system. But over the very long term, the rates should really equilibrate with essentially the global interest rate regimes, right? So you would have the DAI savings rate for the US dollar pegged DAI, you know, and landing around the interest rate for US dollars, right? And in general, that's how it will play out because ultimately it's an arbitrage opportunity, right? So if the DAI savings rate is significantly higher than the rest of the global economy, you'll just have, you know, people shifting over their assets into DAI until the interest rate goes down.
Yeah, makes sense. So it'll be, I think that's going to be a very highly used product. I think a lot of people are wanting to earn interest on there. And of course, it's going to depend on the supply and demand, but a lot of people are wanting to earn steady interest on their crypto. And you can do it on Compound. I think that's around 3% for DAI right now, but kind of being built into the Maker system is going to be powerful. We've talked about governance a lot. I personally think, you know, governance is very early on blockchain systems. It's going to kind of take years for us to fully figure it out. What's kind of your take on how the systems work so far? I mean, I guess one of my biggest things I see, there's very low voter turnout and apathy. It seems to me like voters kind of just follow the suggestions of the teams that they put out. Do you kind of see this changing over time, or what do you think the solutions are to kind of getting this voter apathy to turn around?
Yeah, so when we designed the Maker governance system, we predicted that voter apathy would exist, right? And in the end, we've ultimately the other part of the story is that we don't even really think that voter sentiment is that important in terms of making decisions, right? Because what we want with Maker is a system that is governed to be optimally stable, right? And work as best as it possibly can for the users. And that is actually not necessarily completely aligned with, what MKR holders would choose if they just got to choose whatever is best for them, right? Like if you really made it what I called it, the choose your own adventure style of governance, where it's really just a popularity contest of whatever people want to vote for, right? So what we've actually focused heavily on with Maker governance is to essentially just look at MKR and on-chain voting more of a security mechanism, and maybe even you could say an oracle mechanism that ultimately votes through what has been agreed upon in sort of the higher layer of the governance process, which is the social layer, right? Like the actual discussion around like what is it we want to achieve and how do we achieve it and what's the data and what's the models and what's the theory that supports what we want to do, right? So that is what I think we are incredibly advanced at and doing incredibly well at with Maker, right? So we have these weekly governance meetings with just a huge turnout, right? Incredible participation of like experts from all around the world, right? And in particular, we have things like institutional stakeholders, right? So hedge funds and other types of institutions, right? That have bought MKR, and then as a result, they're incentivized to really participate in this process of you know, deciding and collaborating on really doing the optimal governance of the system. And as a result, we are in this situation where it's not, I mean, what that means is that it's not the team, for instance, it's not the foundation that decides what, you know, what the governance community is going to vote on. It is really the governance community that together as a group, right, makes that decision on its own. And we have the whole framework for this. We call it scientific governance, right? So the goal is to use the scientific method as much as possible to ultimately achieve scientific consensus, right? Which means a consensus primarily of, you know, highly informed experts, right? Or like the closest to consensus you can get of that. And then ultimately you go with that decision because that's, you know, the best choice is to rely on evidence and facts and data, right? And use that to guide your decision-making. And then MKR holders, their role is really just voting that through, right? Of course, there's also ways, I mean, you get kind of like sentiment and data and input out of MKR holders. But ultimately, like I was saying, right, we don't want it to be a popularity contest. We don't want it to be just like whatever, you know, whatever coins that some big MKR holder has will just get the best risk parameters because, you know, he's incentivized to vote for that, right? We want to make sure that there's some sort of objective framework that ultimately provides the reason for why the risk parameters and the you know, the terms of the system are the way they are, right? It can't just be arbitrary.
Yeah, I think that's very important. I mean, just a single coin vote to control the system, you know, you're going to get whales manipulating and all that. So you need to add some more to it. So that's very interesting to hear you say. You said scientific governance. So what happens, I guess, if just imagine the peg was down at 9.6 still or 0.96 still, and, you know, the stability fee was not up at 3.5, or maybe we even raised it to 3.5 and it didn't fix it. It needs to go to 7. And a vote goes on and Maker holders vote against it. And maybe your team or the foundation or whoever it might be thinks that can put the system at risk. And maybe that's a bad example, but just imagine a proposal passes where it could put the system at risk. Is there any way or what would happen at that point?
Well, so, I think so. Better example here, like to just put it more on the edge, right, is to talk about attacks, right? Because I strongly believe that ultimately all honest MKR holders and all honest participants in the system will vote accordingly to the scientific governance, right? Because that's just a really, you know, it really provides the proof that this is the best way for you to vote because this is what all the data, all the models, all the knowledge that we have tells us this is how we do our best to control the system. And as a result, you know, for instance, that'll make the MKR token the most valuable, right? Because that'll make the system the best in the long run, right? So I think a more interesting case that is a lot more, you know, very, very likely or like very, something that really has to be considered, right, are governance attacks. So essentially, a malicious actor buying up, let's say, 51% of the MKR supply, right, so that they actually get control over the governance of the system. And once that happens, I mean, you have a pretty serious situation, right? Because someone who controls the governance of the system can actually, for instance, print infinite die, right? They can just like add some sort of total garbage made up ERC-20 token and then give it an infinite debt ceiling and you know, just print you know, 10 trillion DAI, right? And try to cash it out. So you don't want that to happen, right? Like obviously the system has to have very strong measures in place to prevent something like that from ever happening under any circumstances, right? Like it's not enough that you just try to make it very unlikely or try to kind of like, you know, make it, you know, like remove the incentive or something to do this. You really have to be able to guarantee that under no circumstances can it ever happen, right? And where, like, what that leads us to is, like, first of all, the fact, like, the principle of security delays, right? So any sort of modification that's made to the system, such as a governance action, is always done with a very long delay to it, right? So you actually try to, like, implement the change to the system, but the change, the new state, doesn't go through until after a significant waiting period. And in this waiting period, this is where, you know, the community has a chance to protect against attacks, right? This is where there's a chance to basically, you know, like, and really a guarantee that as long as there's just like a very minimal level of honest actors in the system, you'll be able to completely mitigate an attack. And the way it's mitigated is through what's known as the emergency shutdown. So the emergency shutdown is actually, like, it's pretty much the most important feature of the system, right? It's the feature that guarantees you as a DAI holder that ultimately the worst thing that can happen to you is that the system shuts down, and for every, you know, for every DAI you have, you're going to get $1 worth of collateral. And you can really go and you can verify this is the case in the code, and you can go and you can verify that the assets are there in the blockchain, and that's how you know that, okay, no matter what happens, this is going to be worth $1, right? And that's really how all of these edge cases are handled, right? Basically, any sort of, like, in any sort of edge case outlier emergency scenario to the system, the only real outcome is to shut it down and basically say, okay, we're not going to put our users at risk under any circumstances. Instead, what we're going to do is we're going to allow them to gracefully exit the system at exactly the, you know, the net value that they're entitled to. And then immediately after doing an emergency shutdown, depending on the circumstances in where it happened, right, you will usually be able to just redeploy and restart the system again in the exact same state, except you can remove whatever bad parts that caused the emergency shutdown in the first place. So for instance, if someone tries to do a 51% attack, you'll do an emergency shutdown of the system, and then you'll relaunch the system, but you'll relaunch it without the MKR of the attacker, right? So he basically gets to pay the price of getting all his MKR forked out of the distribution, right? And everyone else, they just switch over to the new system. I mean, it's not going to, like, it's an annoyance, obviously, but it's actually possible to handle it quite gracefully. So for regular users, all an emergency shutdown that is redeployed and ultimately allows the system to go on, all they have to do is just click a button on the phones, right? They just have to, like, click a button to upgrade the DAI, quite similar to how they have to upgrade the DAI from single collateral DAI to multi-collateral DAI. So, I mean, it gets more advanced than this, obviously, but this is kind of like the fundamentals of the game theory around how the governance ultimately is kept safe from all sorts of strange edge cases.
Yeah, it's very important to have a prevention mechanism in there. I mean, it's kind of like how I envision a 51% attack on proof of stake would work. Like, you can just kind of, you would, well, in Ethereum 2.0 case, you would slash the malicious actor or essentially kind of fork them out of the network, and it ended up costing them a lot more money than the damage that was actually done. So it's interesting to hear you talk through it. You know, we talked a lot about what the future holds, multi-collateral DAI, DAI savings rate, the future of the governance. What are the other things that your team's looking at? I know I've seen talk of decentralizing the oracles. And also, is there plans to move someday from just being pegged to the US dollar to maybe Euro DAI or a basket of currencies?
Yeah, so the plans for the oracles is primarily, it is to, first of all, like, the most important thing with the oracles is to also completely mitigate the impact of malicious oracles in the system, right? So this is done with the same logic as how malicious governance is mitigated, right? It is by imposing a delay on the data from the oracles and ultimately reacting to bad data by shutting down the system and restarting it without the malicious oracles. And in terms of, like, other features that's coming next, right? I mean, first of all, the main focus after launch of MCD is to really focus on security tokens and real-world assets as collateral. because that's kind of one of the most exciting things that's going to really like show, you know, show the world just how powerful decentralized finance is and how powerful the blockchain is once it starts actually interacting with the real world, right? And it's also what's going to solve the scalability issue. It means that DAI can now scale to trillions of dollars if it has to, with no problem, as long as it has this link to the real world and can use things like real estate, bonds, and so on, right? And then the next step after adding all these security tokens and adding the real world assets as collateral is getting into the, yeah, like the frontier of synthetic assets and basically multiple target assets, right? So instead of just having DAI that's pegged to the dollar, eventually we'll have you know, all sorts of DAI tokens pegged to all sorts of assets. So we'll have, you know, Euro DAI and Yen DAI and Pound DAI and so on, right? And really, in the end, there'll be DAI that's pegged to every single currency, right? It doesn't end there. It goes beyond just currency. It goes to actually any type of assets. So we'll have synthetic assets for eventually literally anything, right? Stocks, bonds, commodities, anything you can think about, right? Even very complicated stuff like indices or, you know, stuff that doesn't even exist right now, like assets that are more like prediction markets really than actual assets in the real world, right? As long as you can produce a price feed for it and there are people who actually want to trade that asset and use that asset as a currency or use it as some sort of speculative instrument, it'll be possible to create a synthetic version of it. And it's possible to do so with almost the exact same code base as what is used for just for the very basic DAI system. So once we sort of get going with that, it'll be incredibly easy for the community to just continuously deploy new synthetic assets for anything it wants to. And ultimately, all of that will be handled entirely by the decentralized governance.
Nice. Yeah, you guys definitely have no lack of work on your roadmap. That's for sure. A lot of cool stuff coming. I've talked about this question and it just popped in my head with a couple of guests. I talked to Nadav from Dharma about it. I personally start to get worried down the road as this stuff grows and open finance is definitely not just Maker. But we start to introduce a lot of risk into these systems that maybe we're not aware of. And all of a sudden, you know, you've got, multi-collateral DAI going, and who knows, you've got someone like collateralizing a God's Unchained card, right, into their CDP to pull out Augur, and there's not a lot of liquidity there. That's an extreme example, but do you ever worry a little bit about how we're going to track the risk of all this in the future?
Not as long as we use best practices, right? And what we need to do, it's quite clear what we need to do to avoid something like, you know, the financial crisis, right? Some sort of financial meltdown. It really depends on two things, right? Number one is, and the most important is transparency and access to data, right? So it's very, very important to know exactly what's going on. And it's very important that everyone knows exactly what's going on, right? Not just some, you know, secret elite group or something, or like special privileged people know what's going on and everyone else just assume it's going to be fine, right? Ultimately, we need complete transparency of decentralized finance in order to keep it safe. Because if we have that complete transparency, then the second thing is, then we just need to apply the right risk models, right? And like do the best possible effort at trying to manage the risk of this. Ultimately, then we can do better than what's currently going on in the financial system, right? Because the current financial system really has neither of those things, right? There's not really perfect access to data and transparency. And the models that are being used are not really like, you know, like the most optimal scientific models, but rather like all sorts of proprietary models used all over the place. And that's going to be the big advantage that decentralized finance has. I mean, the example you brought up, right? That's an example of something where probably if the models and the data is used correctly, you're not really going to see a lot of, you know, like gaming cards being used as collateral for other types of synthetic tokens or something. I mean, there will be some of that, right? Because again, you should be able to use anything as collateral. But there just has to be very strong checks and balances on how much that can be done, right? And essentially, the moment there's too much of a buildup in risk in one part of the system, what you have to do is you have to basically disincentivize that, right? Which you can do either by blocking it entirely with a debt ceiling or through some sort of autonomous mechanism that just jacks up the interest rates as risk builds up further.
Yeah, I think zero knowledge proofs are going to throw an interesting wrench into this and like the transparency of everything. But I guess on the system side of things, those won't be implemented, so it'll still be transparent. But like, you know, we have zero knowledge ERC-20 tokens as a EIP right now, right? So like that privacy is close and coming for sure. So I think just the last question I have for you is actually kind of outside of all the intricacies of the system we've been talking about today, and it's more just about the transition to ETH 2.0 someday. So obviously, you know, come like phase two of ETH 2.0, we're going to have state transitions, but I think it'll be a little bit slower of a transition for some of the larger applications than people think. Have you had any internal discussions about the transition to ETH 2.0 someday?
Not really. I mean, it's not something we focus too much on yet. Something that's interesting is that it's not really like there's not really any guarantee that the Ethereum ecosystem will actually transition over to ETH 2.0, right? You could easily have a scenario where the Ethereum apps decide to move to some other blockchain, because what's actually going to happen is just the old Ethereum blockchain will just get shut down, right? And then people have to move. But it's not really that there's not really going to be anything that's going to facilitate the move over to specifically ETH 2.0. That being said, I mean, I think almost certainly that's where all the momentum will go, right? Like, unless the technical roadmap just completely fails or for whatever reason, right? The community gets too toxic or something. I mean, but almost certainly it will eventually be this like very, there'll be this momentum in the community to move over. And I could imagine that it will really be that when the actual transition happens, it'll be a coordination amongst a lot of the different applications and a lot of the different, businesses and ecosystem around it. And then it'll be this like big event essentially where basically the bulk of the bulk of the users and the bulk of the network on Ethereum will decide, okay, Ethereum 2.0 is ready at this point, and it's time that we actually move over. And then it'll be quite coordinated in a period of time where then there'll be like massive like turmoil, obviously, in terms of nothing works, suddenly everything is in maintenance mode and is switching over. But then from there, it'll be quite graceful, right? Because then you will have all the clout and all of the network effect now sitting on ETH 2.0. And then finally, the long-term outlook will be completely stable, right? Because that'll go on forever.
Yeah, definitely. It'll be a very interesting period once we get there. Hopefully it's sooner rather than later. But I agree with you. I think it'll kind of be a coordinated move for a lot of the larger applications. Well, Rune, I really appreciate you joining me. I think this has been a great conversation, and thanks for joining the podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Into the Ether podcast. You can subscribe to us at podcast.ethub.io, as well as follow us on Twitter at econoar and at Zazzle 0x.